Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 233, following on from the diamond-studded episode 232, where the new treasure of the Northern Cape had begun to be exploited. This is an episode packed with odd resonances, echoes, large whiskers, many presidents, and the origin of a modern bank. Now that the diamond fields were being exploited, this being 1870, a plethora of politicians lined up to claim ownership. The ever-ambitious and unrealistic President Pretorius of the Transvaal amongst those, and who, as you heard last episode, had been chased away by the diggers. The diggers were an international lot, not prone to being intimidated by old bearded men from the Transvaal. His attempt at unilaterally granting rights to the diamond fields to Messrs. Webb, Posner and Munich had gone down like a lead balloon. As you heard too, Nicholas Waterboer also claimed these fields, as well as the Free State government under President Steyn. Waterboer was persuaded by his Cape-educated lawyer, the vigorous pen-and-ink warfare expert David Arnott, to ask the British government to honour his claim on behalf of the Griqua. Waterboer didn't need much convincing. Author and journalist Frederick Boyle, who wrote To the Cape for Diamonds, published in 1873, respected Arnott, meeting him in 1871, describing him as very short, very thick, with a large face clean-shaven and a dark skin burnt darker by South African suns. Mr. David Arnott is one of those gentlemen who, in a larger or smaller sphere, make history. He'd conducted Waterboer's business for 17 years, and as Boyle said, had made not one mistake. Which is a miracle, considering the forces at work in the Transvaal. A diplomat's diplomat, they said about him, tenacious, unfailing, undaunted. He was President Pretorius and President Brandt's nemesis in some ways, a highly educated coloured man who was connected to the levers of power. He was also relatively wealthy, working as an attorney in Colesberg, earning £2,000 a year. A man of his time, like other educated men and women of the Victorian era, he collected plants and wrote letters to famous scientists in his spare time. He sometimes looks like a Griqua and sometimes like a European, writes Boyle. But all times he looks shrewd and has his eyes open. Devout imperialist and friend Richard Southey agreed, but the incoming High Commissioner, Sir Henry Barclay, needed to be persuaded. He had just arrived, sporting enormous black whiskers, a large commanding figure, an authoritarian, gruff, former member of the English Parliament. He didn't want to be dragged into some territorial dispute so early in his governorship. He'd replaced Sir Philip Wodehouse as High Commissioner. Wodehouse congratulated himself when he left in May 1870, saying not a shot had been fired by a British soldier during his stint as Governor of the Cape, which was a stunning turnaround from the preceding 70 years, particularly the turbulent 1840s. During the interregnum between the discovery of diamonds and the annexation of the diamondiferous land by Great Britain, a short-lived but highly entertaining Free Diamond Republic sprang into being. Self-appointed, proudly chaotic, and run by the diggers for the diggers. The Diggers' Republic had all the trappings, including a flag, which, according to historical accounts, featured the Union Jack in the top corner, similar to other colonial flags of the era, and its president, Stafford Parker was his name, and he was to rule over the territory for the grand total of 12 months. One reporter from London said that he behaved modestly, as does honour to his position. The order of the day is solid civility. Listen to, but say nothing, and dig away. The golden rule amongst treasure hunters, stay stumm as you grind away. Well, he clearly twigged that there was more to this presidency gig than dusty speeches. Spotting a golden opportunity, he did what any enterprising head of state might do. He opened his own music hall right there in the middle of the diggings. A few extra pounds never hurt, right? After all, what's the point of declaring yourself president if you can't milk it for a bit of showbiz and a pound or two on the side? And just to send the whole madcap tale cartwheeling into the absurd, this diamond field commander-in-chief, this ruler of a ramshackle realm, had once been, yes, an able seaman. Folks from the high seas to the high veld From mizzen masts to muddy claims, only in the Free Diamond Republic could such a journey make perfect sense. So who exactly was this oddity served up to us through the maze of history, this Stafford Parker? He was first a British artist, then a seaman, then a trader, before becoming one of the miners, and, of course, a music hall owner. He arranged a group of miners into an armed unit that was known as the Mutual Protection Association, a kind of vigilante group, but more defensive in nature than offensive. As soon as it became apparent that the diamond fields were disputed by a long list of local and international agents, the diggers were determined to protect what was theirs. Parker had worked as a trader amongst the Kurrana before diamonds were discovered, and soon made his name as a diamond dealer. So it was then, on the 30th of July 1870, a year before he launched his music hall, that Stafford Parker found himself at a Klipdrift open-air meeting across the Vaal River from Peniel, standing in front of a large group of diggers.
13 years ago, he boomed, when I was trading in this country, it was entirely populated by natives and until now has been governed according to the custom of the several tribes.
The diggers listened intently.
Now, however, that the country has turned out to be valuable, claimants are cropping up from every quarter. I hope that the diggers will stand by one another, and then they need to fear no state or power in South Africa, and they might declare for a republic if they liked. Great applause and enthusiasm. The assembled wide-brimmed hat and corduroy suit brigade liked the message, and his diggers' republic was received with many cheers and an irregular salute of musketry, just as all good ideas should be saluted with an irregular musket salute.
A genuine orator, he commanded a gathering and was at home in any company with white top hat, magnificent whiskers, and Victorian pimp threads standing out among the throng. Once he and his fellow Mutual Protection Committee members had dispatched President Pretorius's commando, if you remember last episode, they settled into their new republic. After a few months, he launched the Stafford Parker Music Hall in January 1871, thus joining a long line of characters who launched their own salacious palaces. Take Charles Morton, known as the father of the halls, a legendary figure of British entertainment who opened Canterbury Music Hall in 1852. And how about a more modern example to go from the sublime to the purple, which was Prince, who started Paisley Park as a venue that featured dance parties, intimate gigs, and much jollification, a personal creative kingdom. Or what about Dolly Parton's Dollywood, which admittedly is more a theme park than a music hall, and Jay-Z started the 40-40 Club, which wasn't quite music hall, more sports bar music lounge. Still, you get the picture. Oh, President Stafford Parker, ever the showman with a wink and a waistcoat, launched his corrugated iron canteen at Klipdrift on the banks of the Vaal with all the flair of a Mar-a-Lago meets muddy boots. Not content with presiding over a ragtag republic of diggers and dreamers, Parker decided he'd double as chief entertainer and purveyor of refreshments, slinging drinks and good cheer beneath a roof of rippling iron. Why not? If you're going to rule, you might as well pour the pints too. The canteen doubled up as assembly hall for the diggers, for the republic, in which drinks were served at all times, day or night. On Sunday morning, the previous evening's excesses were removed, bodies dragged out into the Namaqualand sunshine to sober up, and thus cleared the hall was then used for church service. But it wasn't all brandy and gunfire. Parker was a stern man, a disciplinarian, who took pleasure in training the diggers. He would form them up, warning that, "Someday we will have to defend ourselves." In 1870, on a winter's day, he formed up a group of diggers and marched them four deep to the music of a fiddle, a concertina and a cracked drum, up and down the uneven Klipdrift main street, dust kicked up by the energetic paraders. According to one would-be troop, writing later, "Every now and then an inebriated digger, unable to preserve his gravity, would fall on his nose, amidst the general laughter of all those on parade." Photos exist, I'm told, of these parades, but I have not been able to locate one yet. Unfortunately, Stafford Parker's Diggers Republic was to be short-lived. Klipdrift, that boom town of grit and glitter, wouldn't stay Klipdrift for long. Soon enough, with British boots on the ground and bureaucracy in the air, it was renamed Barclay West, a polite colonial nod to Sir Henry Barclay, the new High Commissioner. But make no mistake, before the suits arrived, Parker's pub presidency was in full swing, half state, half saloon, all swagger. This was all happening before the discovery of the mother lode that was the Kimberley volcanic pipe from where most diamonds washed downstream and had been found. A steady influx of immigrants and migrant workers would become a tsunami and was going to stretch the capacity of South Africa's logistics, but also provide an amazing opportunity for the industrious. The problem was the new British Prime Minister Gladstone was unwilling to face the trouble and expense of more colonies, at least immediately. And so in July 1870, at about the time that the Diggers' Republic began flexing its digging muscles and marching about, Colonial Secretary Earl Kimberley began to change his mind. These days, it's believed that the British wanted to get their sweaty paws on the diamonds, but at the time, there were much bigger internal pressures on English politicians. The wild swings taking place in English politics were making it very difficult to run an empire effectively, you know. Earl Kimberley was certain that if the Free State gained control of the diamond fields, then the Boers' form of apprenticeship slash slavery would be extended. More terrible headlines in the British press. That would not do. Nicholas Waterboer and his lawyer David Arnott constantly pressed the British to annex the land. Eventually, Lord Kimberley relented, but said the Cape should annex Waterboer's territory, not London. The Cape Parliament at this moment was more than reluctant. They dismissed the idea outright. Although the diamond fields were an attractive glitter in the imagination, most Cape parliamentarians were actually sympathetic with the Free Staters who claimed the territory. Even Robert Moffat, the missionary, was against the idea of annexation. And ditto John X. Merriman, who was leading the self-rule movement amongst the Kapanas. The Cape legislature formally rejected the suggestion it annexed the territory. Barclay, the High Commissioner, though, was still in charge. This was not a ceremonial position. It was a kind of a mix of colonial governor, foreign minister and military commander rolled into one. More importantly, the Diggers' Republic Declaration of Independence had reminded him of Australia, because Barclay had spent 7 years as governor of the Australian state of Victoria, and during his time, the Ballarat Rebellion, otherwise known as the Eureka Rebellion, had broken out. This has been called one of the most significant events in Australian history, and seen as a symbol of the young country's democratic resistance to colonial control. It tested British colonialism to the limits, and Barclay could see the parallels to this little diggers' republic. The Eureka Rebellion was quite a moment and also involved miners. Ballarat is around 115 kilometres northwest of Melbourne, and the Ballarat East Goldfields were a rich alluvial gold mining area that exploded into prominence during the Australian gold rush of the 1850s. Tensions arose as miners were hit with monthly license fees, police reinforced the rules violently, and local officials were corrupt. The trigger event to the uprising was the death of a miner named James Scooby, who died in a brawl with the hotel owner and the perceived mishandling of the case by local authorities. In December 1854, around 200 miners built a wooden defensive stockade at the Eureka diggings. They flew the now famous Eureka flag, a symbol of defiance featuring the Southern Cross constellation. At dawn on the 3rd of December, colonial troops and police attacked the stockade. The battle lasted only 15 minutes, but 22 miners and 6 soldiers were killed. The stockade was destroyed, the rebellion crushed, but it triggered a wave of public outcry. The incident is central to Australia's origin storytelling, and the Eureka flag of the Southern Cross was incorporated into Australia's national flag, which they wave around today. So you can understand Barclay's nervousness with all of that buzzing about inside his bewhiskered noggin as he viewed Stafford Parker's republic. Transvaal President Pretorius, having been sent packing by Stafford Parker's diggers secretly and without permission from his own Volksraad, approached Barclay suggesting the British should adjudicate the western border of the Transvaal, which sent Free State President Brandt into a paroxysm of rage. He had already called for international arbitration of some sort, because he thought his country owned the diamond fields. Brandt dispatched Pieter Johannes Trutte as magistrate to Pniel across the Vaal River from Klipdrift, but there was already a magistrate in Klipdrift, Maximilian John Campbell, simply referred to as Max by most. He was acting as a British-appointed official representing the interests of Nicolaas Waterboer, the Griqua leader,
who, as you know, had claimed sovereignty. Tudor's presence was seen as a provocation by both the British and the diggers, despite Brandt's insistence on the legality of the Free State's claim. For a couple of months, these two magistrates stared each other down across the Vaal River. Meanwhile, because, of course, in this episode of Grand Diplomacy, we need a meanwhile, Natal's Lieutenant Governor Robert Keat suddenly revealed his government's decision on the border business. Keat announced that the Transvaal's western boundary would be pushed back to allow the Tlaping their land, and summarily awarded the diamond fields to Nicolaas Waterboer the Griqua, who of course would then request the British annex his land. Bada bing, as one of my friends would say, sorted. Barclay annexed Waterboer's lands as the new crown colony of Griqua Land West on November 17, 1871. Brandt was gobsmacked. Then, when word got out about Pretorius's behind-his-back approach to the British, the Transvaal president was forced to resign by his Volksraad. So President Brandt of the Free State went ballistic, and with good reason. Legally, the Orange Free State had a rock-solid case. The British had signed the Bloemfontein Convention with the Boers, black ink on white paper, you know, promising not to make treaties with any African chiefs north of the Orange River. And now, here they were, doing exactly that with Nicolaas Waterboer. Blatantly, brazenly, without so much as a blush, unashamed, unabashed, unbelievable. But this meant the British had also taken possession of a new colony in the midst of trying desperately not to do so in southern Africa. British Kaffraria had just been ceded to the Cape, the British Parliament sighing with relief. And in 1871, Basutoland was temporarily palmed off to the Cape as well. For the moment, Great Britain was landed with an expensive and unworkable small third colony, albeit one that was glittering with opportunity. Ah, yes, the mayhem when it comes to empires and their broken promises. Brandt wouldn't let the matter die, badgering the British government until another Prime Minister, Disraeli, relented. Or at least his colonial secretary, Henry Herbert, relented. He was the Lord of Carnarvon, and agreed to pay the Free State the measly sum of £90,000 for the diamond fields in 1876. And here's something really interesting. The money went straight into the formation of the National Bank of the Orange Free State, which evolved over time and after the Anglo-Boer War was amalgamated with other colonial and regional banks. But wait, there's more. This all actually started with the Eastern Province Bank, established in Grahamstown to finance the wool export market in 1838. Over time, that bank expanded, adding branches in other towns. A recession in the 1870s led to the Eastern Province Bank being bought out by the Oriental Bank Corporation, the OBC. Then the OBC withdrew from South Africa, and the Bank of Africa was formed in 1879 to take over OBC's operations. In 1914, the Bank of Africa merged with the National Bank of the Orange Free State. Yes, Brandt's bank, formed with money from Carnarvon, and also joined up with the African Banking Corporation to become the National Bank of South Africa. It operated as the leading bank, but by the 1920s was struggling because of agricultural downturn after the First World War. In 1925, the National Bank of South Africa merged with two other banks, the Anglo-Egyptian Bank and the Colonial Bank, its new name, Barclays Bank, Dominion, Colonial and Overseas. After Barclays Bank disinvested during the apartheid-era pressure in the 1980s, it was renamed First National Bank and remains one of South Africa's big four banks today. So, if you use FNB services, you link to quite a bit of history. Back to 1871. As the initial kerfuffle died down, a third president was happy to let the matter slide, and that was President Stafford Parker of the Diggers' Republic, who handed over the reins of power willingly before mounting his horse, picking up his own reins, and cantering out of Klipdrift, last seen heading north. Stafford Parker would end up in the Transvaal goldfields by the 1880s, opening a bar in Market Square in Lydenburg, turning his hand to auctioneering, eventually moving to Barberton, where he ran the local produce market. For the rest of his life, he would be known as ex-president Stafford Parker, and according to all reports, dressed presidentially, white top hat, tails, all the trimmings, his giant moustache and whiskers, reminiscent of the 21st century male face hair cults. Next episode, we'll focus on what was happening in the East, and perhaps we'll jog up the coast to meet with King Mpande Ka Zenzangakona of the AmaZulu, Cetshwayo was waiting for the old man to pass on, and he didn't have long to wait. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about various episodes. You can also email me from there or sign up for my monthly newsletter. Till we meet again, au revoir.